Gardner talking about white powder gold, one of the most interesting dreamlands I think I can ever remember doing. Upcoming in the new year, we've got all kinds of cool stuff happening. John Hoag, our resident prophet, is going to be back with us, and plus, he's going to be in the subscriber section talking to you live about your prophecy ideas and your expectations for the new year. And what does he have to prophesy about your life? Join our live chat with John Hoag as soon as it's scheduled in January. We've got so much going at so many different levels. Dreamland is going to be an exciting year ahead, believe you me. It's nearly, I think it's my ninth year doing Dreamland. It's hard to believe that I've been doing it that long, because every week it feels like it's just starting for the first time. And that's why I love it so much. I'm just fascinated. The things we've got coming up, a new book on catastrophes that explains what actually happened 13,000 years ago that blew this whole planet into a cocked hat. Amazing work of scientists, and this is not speculation at all. Careful scientists have gone around the world examining the debris. They will tell us exactly what changed our world so profoundly, what maybe brought about the end of Atlantis. Just amazing, amazing stuff. There's the Blue Pearl meditation up on the website. Don't miss that if you're a subscriber to unknowncountry.com. There's real energy there. And, you know, I always talk about 2012, and I say to people, well, people say to me, what's going to happen? And I say, well, maybe nothing for most people, but for those who are willing to open their minds, maybe everything. Be willing to open your mind. You know, after I talked to Lawrence Gardner about white powder gold, I took white powder gold for a few weeks, and then nothing seemed to happen. And then a few months after that, a great deal did happen to me, which I've described in my journals and on the show at various times, and it was weird. The only thing about this is there's two things that you've got to realize. First, there's a lot of white powder gold for sale on the Internet. You don't know what it is. You don't know what it is, and they don't know necessarily what it is. Some of them perhaps do. We're going to have Lawrence Gardner on again in March. He's got a new book out, and Jim Mars is going to interview him. I'm going to interview him. We're going to have a load of fun. We're going to ask him all the latest about white powder gold. But remember this, any heavy metal that you ingest is dangerous for your kidneys. So don't take a lot of that if you're going to take any of it at all. I mean, I was just tried it for a couple of weeks, and that was it. I was very, very careful with it, and you should be too. I might add for you subscribers that in the subscriber section there is an interview, a special interview for subscribers only, with Barry Carter, who makes white powder gold and discusses it and his research into it and what it may be and what making of it entails. It's really fascinating stuff. So go to the way you get to it is you go to the special interviews section, then click on the special interviews archive, and then search on the word Carter, Barry Carter. I think it's from May, or no, I guess it's from December, excuse me, of 2003. It's in there. And folks, those of you who don't subscribe, there's really a wealth of information in that subscriber section. Stuff you just absolutely do not see elsewhere, like what I was just talking about. You won't find that elsewhere. It doesn't exist. So do look for it, those of you who are subscribers, and those of you who aren't, well, click on the subscribe tab and subscribe. You can get Lawrence Gardner's Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark on our website, of course, and you can store, and you will be able to get his new book in March, and it's very exciting stuff. It's always fun that Lawrence Gardner has come back with us. So let's listen to him now talking about white powder gold from 2003. Introduce you once again to one of the greats. Lawrence Gardner, author of Bloodline of the Holy Grail, has been with us a number of times, and it has always been beyond exciting. It's one of those interviews that usually brings me to my feet. Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark is very simply one of the most stunning and, frankly, out-and-out brilliant books I have ever read. This is not going to be a hostile interview. I think you can probably sense that. I am over the moon about this book, and Lawrence is a
a tremendous writer and a tremendous thinker, and he has created in this some extraordinary and exciting insights, and we're going to really have some fun. The subtitle of the book is Amazing Revelations of the Incredible Power of Gold. And, wow, are we going to get into the inner workings of a lost science today? So hang on. Welcome, Lawrence, to the program.
Hello there, Whitley.
Well, it's so wonderful to have you again. I think that everybody listening to this program knows exactly who Lawrence Gardner is. But just in case there are a few of you out there who do not know what this great leader of this community, this loose community of people willing to tempt the edge of thought and exploration, who he is. He is a fellow of the Society of Antiquaries of Scotland. He's a constitutional historian, lecturer. He's a broadcaster, as he will be showing you today. He's distinguished as a Chevalier de Saint-Germain. He is attached to the European Council of Princes as the Jacobite Historiographer Royal. He has been a conservation consultant to the Fine Arts Trade Guild, and his musical work has been performed in London's Royal Opera House. He is a Knight Templar of the Prior of St. Anthony and the Prior of the Sacred Kindred of St. Columba, a most extraordinarily unusual precis, Lawrence. Also, of course, as well as author of Bloodline of the Holy Grail, he's author of Realm of the Ring Lords and Genesis of the Grail Kings. Now, Lawrence, could you tell me a little bit about what some of these titles actually mean? For example, what is the Chevalier... the Chevalier de Saint-Germain. What does this mean?
It's actually a title which has been around for the longest time, actually. The first knight of Saint-Germain was Robert the Bruce in the year 1307. And subsequently what happened was that as the House of Stuart progressed from Robert the Bruce and became the Stuart Kings of Scotland and then Britain, the sort of chief chamberlain to the House of Stuart was always granted that title, the Saint-Germain title, Count of Saint-Germain, Chevalier Saint-Germain, Knight of Saint-Germain, or whatever. And so in a sort of, not exactly a hereditary lineage, but in a lineage of chancellors to the House of Stuart, I was given the title back in 1992, the year that I was appointed to the European Council of Princes to be the sort of key historiographer for the council.
And what is the European Council of Princes?
It's a conglomeration, really, of royal houses in Europe. It was founded in 1946 after the Second World War, and the object really was that the royal houses, whether they were reigning royal houses or past royal houses, deposed or whatever, but the various sons, really, the princes of the royal houses, got together and formed a council. There was a lot of funding at the time from America, oddly enough, for this, and the ambition was to sort of prevent, again, the rise in Europe of extreme political factions like the fascist movement that had been battled against at that time, or indeed even communism at the other end, perhaps. And it was called at the time the International Council of Government. What happened was that as time progressed and the European Common Market and then the European Union as it became was formed, a European Parliament emerged. So at that time, the title was changed from the International Council of Government to become the Council of Princes. And what it's actually done really for the last, 20 years, is to act as a constitutional advisory body. If, for example, the Brussels Parliament issues a dictate to the countries in the European Union, it's the council that will sit in judgment, really, and sort of look at the various constitutions of the countries involved and go back and say, well, look, you can implement that here, but you can't implement it there because the constitution doesn't allow you to. So it's an advisory council.
I see. Well, in any case, it's absolutely fascinating, and it's the most interesting and unusual precis. I can't resist, and I want to get right to the meat of the book, but a Knight Templar of St. Anthony, what is that?
It's very possibly, and I'm not absolutely sure, but it's probably about the oldest order of Knights Templars currently still operating. And it was founded in the time of Mary Queen of Scots, for Mary Queen of Scots. So it's a branch of the Knights Templars that was set up in Scotland. Well, in fact, originally it was set up in France because she was Queen of France for a while before she came to Scotland. And then it became the sort of key Scottish order of Knights Templars in the 1500s.
Well, we will be getting, of course, later in the interview, very deeply into the whole matter of the Knights Templar, and we will be getting into it with a man who knows his stuff. But let's begin by going back 99 years and many thousands of years at the same time. Sir W.M. Flinders Petrie stood upon a wind-torn rocky plateau in the Sinai Desert. Thus begins a story that eclipses Indiana Jones completely with a much more extraordinary truth. What was he doing there, Lawrence?
Well, Petrie at that time, at the beginning of the 1900s, was probably Britain's foremost archaeologist. Archaeology was fairly new. There'd only been archaeologists for about 50 years prior to that, and he was the sort of key man of the time. He was primarily an Egyptologist, but as Sinai historically had always been a part of Egypt in olden times, in the times of ancient Egypt, he was selected really by the Egypt Exploration Society to go out to Sinai, the peninsula that sort of sits alongside the Red Sea, the triangular landmass there. And the object really was to sort of survey the country in general for the Exploration Society, and in particular to look at mining in the area and that sort of thing. It was a turquoise mining area particularly, and copper mining was done there. So he was going to survey the country. So he took a team of chaps out there in 1904, and he decided that while he was there, one of the things that they would do is to follow the directions in the Bible, in the book of Exodus, and to actually explore the mountain of Moses while he was there. So he got the directions, and the first thing that he discovered was that the mountain that the Bible led the team to, was not the mountain that is actually today called Mount Sinai, which sits at the bottom of the peninsula. That particular mountain got its name in the 4th century from a group of Greek Christian monks who decided it was a jolly good place to set up a monastery.
Uh-huh.
But anyway,
so they set the monastery up and then claimed the provenance.
That's right.
Yeah. Mountain,
yeah. I mean, it's a lovely little monastery. It's got a lovely art collection there. It's really quite nice, but it's in the wrong place. The actual mountain is much further north in the country. And if you think about it, if they were traveling across Sinai from Egypt to get to the land of Canaan, Palestine, they would never have had to go way down to the bottom of Sinai to do that. So they would have traveled much more across country to do that. So anyway, he found the mountain, Mount Horeb, as it's called in the Bible. In fact, it doesn't get called Mount Sinai for a while. It's called Mount Horeb,
yes,
effectively in the Bible. And he got there and he found the mountain and he thought, well, this is a very exciting discovery, actually. I think this is the place.
And this word Horeb or Horeb is a very important word. Do you want to discuss it just parenthetically now, or will we go back?
Well, yes, actually, I might as well, because not that I think he probably knew it at the time, but the original word Horeb was spelt with a C. It was C H O R E B, and the C was silent. So in English translation, that it became Horeb, but it was pronounced Horeb, spelt Choreb. And in actual fact, in the more Greco-Roman spelling of the word, it was not Choreb, but Cherub, as in cherub, as in angel cherub, which came from the Semitic word kerub, beginning with a Q or a K, and the word meant flight. Which is interesting. So it was the mountain of flight,
in real terms. The mountain of flight. Well, that is going to definitely tie into what we're going to be discussing. Don't think for a minute this is an ordinary discussion about the past. This is a discussion about the past by a man who knows a lot of secrets. So, back to the Sir Flinders Petrie stands on the mountain of flight without knowing quite what it is and what happens next.
Okay, well, he decided, as all good explorers must, that having got there, it would be jolly nice to climb to the top. And in fact, since they were surveying the country, and it was a pretty high mountain, it rose to about, a little over 2,500 feet above sea level. So he took the team up to the top. And what they discovered when they got very, very close to the top was that it flattened out before the sort of pointy bit, and there's this wonderful great plateau. And it was covered in rubble, but out of the rubble he could see various standing stones and pillars and various things protruding. So they then spent weeks and weeks up this place, got the local Bedouins to help them, and they cleared all this rubble, and lo and behold, they found an ancient Egyptian temple of quite enormous size, about 270 feet on the plateau. This thing came out from the mountain, and then there was a cave at the other end, and it went back a considerable way into the mountain as a sort of inside part of the temple. So it was astonishing. In fact, it was mammoth by any Egyptian standard. And there was this temple, 2,500 feet up a mountain. And so having cleared it, they started to sort of explore it in general, and found all sorts of amazing things. I mean, the furniture was still there. There were altars, and there were tables, and various things of that sort. There were lots of small artifacts.
Wooden furniture? Was it that well preserved?
No, it was stone. Stone altars. Everything there was stone. It was stone altars, stone tables. But what struck him as rather odd was the shape of these things. They weren't actually shapes like church altars one might imagine them to be. They had sort of recessed fronts on them. They had split level surfaces. And they looked really more like workbenches of some sort. And they found all sorts of very strange items there, including crucibles, metallurgist crucibles, and things that generally didn't seem to belong in a church. Well, subsequently, what actually happened was that once he was back and the linguists got hold of a lot of the stuff, to cut a long story short, the word that we now have as worship is really the interesting word. And I checked this out with the Oxford Word Library, and we checked it right back to its origin and found that actually the word worship only really entered the English language as such in about the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. And prior to that, the word was workship. Workship.
Work-ship.
And workship was carried out in workshops called temples. So what was discovered was, in actual fact, it was a mammoth discovery, actually, because it was discovered there that temples in those times were different to churches. They were not about venerating gods. They were about working for gods or working for kings. And the priests had amazing names. The priests were called things like the Great Artificer or the Great Vulcan, that sort of thing. You know, the titles that seemed to have very alchemical rings to them, or the rings of a workshop rather than the ring of a church, you know?
It's beginning to sound like we're not even talking about a temple in the sense that we mean, but about a place that has other dimensions as well.
Yeah. I mean, subsequent to that, looking again, as they did at temples in Egypt and in Mesopotamia, this same sort of theme seemed to follow, although nobody had ever really clued into it before, because it was thought that these were places of veneration, of religion. And they weren't about religion as such. They were about working for the masters, whoever the masters were, whether they were the kings or the gods or whatever. And it was really a question of trying to work out what they did in this workshop, in this temple, this massive temple. There were reliefs all over the walls, carvings. There were carvings on obelisks, there were carvings on standing stones, and all of these things were quite astonishing, because that the whole place was dedicated to the Egyptian goddess Hathor, and it seemed to be related totally to gold. It was called the House of Gold. The inscriptions kept saying, "This is the House of Gold." There were relief carvings there of the treasurers, and the treasurers were called the great guardians or the overseers of the House of Gold. And in the portrayals, they're shown sort of making presentations of what look like cakes, conical cakes, to the pharaohs. And the age of this thing was quite enormous. It actually, the inscriptions go right back from the 18th dynasty, around the time of Moses and Akhenaten, that sort of period, 1300 BC, that sort of time frame. And they go right back to about 2600, 2700 BC. And
that is really, that's
it was
deep
astonishingly
in the old.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before the break, even between the two kingdoms.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it's before the era that the pyramids are attributed to, this sort of 2,500-year period. And so it was the fourth dynasty that seemed to actually establish this temple.
And how long did the temple continue to function?
Well, it functioned from about 2,600 BC to about 1,300 BC. So you're looking at a considerable time span there.
Yeah, over 1,000 years.
That's right, yeah. And all the time through that, each pharaoh had his own statues there or his relief carvings, and each of them showed the various pharaohs being presented with these strange bread cakes. And the bread cakes had a name, and they called them mufkuts. The hieroglyph translated to M-F-K-Z-T.
When I saw that word in the book, I thought, oh my goodness, I hope he pronounces it before I have to.
Oh, well, I mean, nobody really knows. I spoke to the Egypt Exploration Society, and they said, well, you know, you can throw in whatever vowels you like, really. It's M-F-K-Z-T.
Yeah, right, whatever vowels you need to make the word
yeah,
work.
So yeah, so, I mean, generally, I just put a couple of U's in it, and Mufkut sounds as good as anything because it kind of says what it is.
Right.
But they didn't know what Mufkut was. They had no idea what it was. Whenever they found the word, it seemed to be related to these cakes, these sort of presentation bread-looking things. And alongside them was generally the hieroglyph for light. You know, the sort of the circle with the dot in the middle, the light symbol that the Egyptians used. So,
yes.
So this mufkut seemed to be related to light. It seemed to be related to bread. And there were these conical cakes there. Well, interestingly, and this didn't happen until afterwards, but at the Temple of Karnak in Egypt, there's a wonderful relief there which shows the treasures of Pharaoh Thutmose III. And it's a brilliant relief because it's actually got the shelves, and laid out on these shelves are all his treasures in a relief form. And underneath them, it tells you what they are. And on one of the shelves, there is a whole line of these conical things, just the same as they were finding at the temple in Sinai. And it actually explains underneath them, and these are within the gold section. There's a silver section and a gold section and a gem section on the shelves. And they're within the gold section. And it says, these are the cones of white bread, and they are made of gold. So, the thing kind of tied together. The house of gold, the cakes, the conical-shaped cakes, the presentations, the overseers of the House of Gold, and the fact that the bread cakes said to be the
made
treasures
of gold.
Of the
bread made of gold, something
made
you
of
can
gold,
eat,
yeah.
In other words, that's actually made of gold.
That's right, except they were white, so positively white in color.
So now, has any of this white substance ever been found?
Well, yeah, I mean, Petri actually made the discovery at that time. I mean, what he didn't know was that some of it had been found before, but the thing that clued him in really was the story of Moses from the book of Exodus. And he was on the mountain of Moses, and the strange story in Exodus, which precedes the Israelites moving on from the mountain, and it's the story which relates to the Ark of the Covenant and all of the fire and brimstone that was going on at the mountain. And what happened was that when Moses came down from the mountain, having apparently got the Ten Commandments, he came down and discovered that in his absence, his brother and the Israelites had got a little fed up with hanging around. And so his brother had collected up all the gold, all the earrings and various gold bands and whatever from the Israelites, melted this gold down and made, as an idol of worship, a golden calf. Now, that's fairly straightforward. It upset Moses, but there's nothing odd about that.
Right.
But the next bit of the story is very odd. And the next bit of the story is, and remember, this is taking place at the mountain where Petra is now standing.
Hmm.
The next bit of the story says, and when Moses saw the golden calf, he took it from his brother, he confiscated it, he burnt it with fire, he transposed it into powder, mixed it in water, and fed it to the Israelites. And the baffling thing about that, the thing that really made me wonder, and has made other scholars wonder, I suppose, in the past, is that it doesn't really matter how you heat gold, whether you do it slowly or fiercely. If you heat gold, you get molten gold. You certainly
right.
don't get powder.
No.
And so there was the anomaly. The anomaly was that at this house of gold, at this mountain, Petra is there, he is looking at these bread cakes, he knows they're made of gold, they're white, they're conical, they're very, very valuable, they're presented to the kings, and the kings ingest them for whatever reason. And the Moses story is the same.
Yes.
The gold turns into powder.
Powder.
It's used as a food supplement.
And
now,
in
fact... Calf.
Let me just read the from Exodus 32:20 as you have it in the book. And he took the calf which they had made and burnt it in the fire and ground it to powder and strawed it upon the water and made the children of Israel drink of it. That is exactly what this ritual punishment or ritual action was as described in Exodus. So now go ahead, Lawrence.
Well, I mean, it sounds, doesn't it, when you read that, as if it's some sort of a punishment, really. I mean, that's the way it reads. But in effect, what seems to have been the case was that the white powder of gold, which was highly valuable, highly venerated, was fed to the kings and the pharaohs and the high priests in a particular manner. It was either turned into little cakes and eaten, or it was mixed with water and drunk. And so what Moses was really doing there was not punishing anybody. He was introducing them to something that maybe he knew about and maybe they didn't, or perhaps they even did. But this was a custom. It was a ritual. And it transpires that this material, this white powder of gold, seemed to have quite amazing qualities when ingested. And the qualities were that, and this is the reason why it was given to the senior people, was that it was supposed to heighten certain qualities of leadership. It would heighten awareness. It would heighten perception. It would heighten powers of judgment, that sort of thing. And it was also reckoned to have the power of active longevity, which doesn't necessarily mean that it makes one live longer, but the word active is important because what it seems to mean is that even though one might die at the age one was anticipating to die, you probably wouldn't have contracted any terrible disease. You might have just died from old age because that's as old as you got. But it seemed to have a healing quality to it. So it allowed active physical abilities to move on much later in life. And in fact, when one considers the Bible stories, we've got some extraordinarily great ages in there. I'm not really talking about those very early on in the story where people seem to live for hundreds of years.
Right.
But even, you know, in the sort of latter part of it as we move on, the kings do seem to be leading troops into battle when they're in their 70s and 80s. When they're really quite elderly and would generally be considered to be past it. So clearly this had some very positive effect. Anyway, what Petri did was that they searched this place and the temple itself, the sort of outside part of the temple, in fact all of it was built on this plateau. It was a sandstone plateau. So there was no floor laid down anywhere. It was just a plateau. The mountain was the floor. Then there was a series of small storerooms. Well, they appeared like storerooms. And when they went into them, and they clearly weren't as important as the bigger halls and shrines, but their floors were covered with heavy flagstones. And they thought, well, this is really quite odd. So they lifted the flagstones, and lo and behold, beneath the flagstones was an amazingly preserved lot of pure, white, unadulterated powder. Petri reckoned that there were many tons of it, and they tried everything. They sieved it, they winnowed it, they gave it every test that they could, trying to find whatever foreign matter might be in it, whether perhaps it was the result of sacrificial ritual, or whether it was from the burning of plants to get alkalized, or whatever, but there was nothing. Whatever they did, it just went through the sieves, fine mesh sieves, nothing there at all, just white powder. And gradually the picture came together. The muffcuts, the cakes, the bread, the gold, the powder were all one and the same. And this temple, this workshop, seems to have been primarily there for the manufacture of this material.
And where the material that was found there was a lot of it found, over a ton, as I recall.
Oh, many, many tons, many actually, tons. He reckoned. I mean, you know, they didn't weigh it all.
Has this material been tested in modern times?
Well, yeah, I mean, that material, in actual fact, what happened was that we're outside we're on the plateau now. We've got these rooms, but the tops are off, you know, the bits of walls are there, the flagstones are there, but there's no roof on the thing. So, I mean, what happened was that they lifted all these flagstones and stood them up against the walls. And, really, I mean, they didn't regard this stuff as anything terribly special. In fact, at one point in time, they thought it was just there to sort of level off the flagstones, as one might lay sand underneath paving stones today, except that there was no reason for the stones to be there. So they just bagged up a bunch of it into a box or a paper bag or whatever it was that they had, and that was eventually sent back to the British Museum in London for testing. And then they came down from the mountain eventually and just left everything as it was. And that was in 1904.
Mm-hmm.
By the time the next expedition went there, which was in 1935, which was an expedition led by Harvard University, that was the end of the white powder. It had been open for all of that time to the desert winds and the storms and the rain, and everything had got to it. So it was totally obliterated by then. But the story of the material that was sent back was quite interesting because... although, again, nobody paid too much interest to it, the test results on it were fairly simple chemical tests, actually. I mean, there was nothing terribly difficult done, but the tests on it showed it to be the same materials as the white powder that had been found in the sarcophagus in the Great Pyramid.
And what were those materials?
They were basically silica. Various things, silica, feldspar, mica, iron, aluminium, in essence. That's basically what it tests as. Now, the interesting thing with that is, and I'll just pop this in now for the sake of it, when one manufactures this material now, starting with gold, real gold, and... there are various methods to manufacture it, but one of the methods to manufacture it is by electronic arcing. Now, this is very interesting because we have the Ark of the Covenant, which turns out to be an electronic capacitor.
Oh, my.
Capable of really, in fact, the power of it generated, its storage capability would have been something like 40 to 50,000 volts, so it would have been enormously powerful. But oddly enough, what happens is when you make this material, and in fact it's a monatomic material, you shock the gold. You shock it so that the atoms become totally confused and they fall apart and they become a powder. They can't join together anymore to become metal. They're simply a powder because you've shocked the hell out of them. Now, when you've done that and you subject it to chemical analysis or even spectroscopic analysis, what it tells you is that it's silica, mica, aluminium, iron, sometimes bits of calcium, exactly the same. And that's the weird thing about monatomic substances, it seems, that once they become monatomic, they do not register as metal anymore.
At all?
Not at all. And interestingly, one other little thing I'll just pop in here, which isn't in the book, they have the University of Washington in St. Louis and NASA... have been working for the past few years on retrieving from the ionosphere a substance which they are calling stardust.
Stardust. Now,
this stardust comes from beyond our solar system. They're finding it at the ratio of about 6 particles to 100,000 particles of all other cosmic dust, so that it's very rare even up there. But this stuff tests as exactly the same. And what they're saying is, they're saying that they feel that this stardust is going to be, because it emanates from what they say is a metal-rich supernova explosion, that they feel that, that this stardust will eventually be one of the key clues to the sort of root of the life force on this planet.
My word.
So it's quite extraordinary.
I should say, well, we can I can hardly wait to get back. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We're back with Lawrence Gardner. We have been discussing a strange white powder that proves to come from two places, ancient Egypt and outer space. Now, Lawrence, the question has to be asked, since this was called bread, and it's clear that Moses made his people drink it, you know, drink it in liquid fluid form, what did it do exactly to people when they consumed it? And have you, since it can be made now, have you ever tried any?
What it seemed to do, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, it apparently had the powers to sort of enhance the qualities which they required from their kings and their high priests and their leaders in general. More recently, it's become a little more apparent precisely what happens, in that this material can be made not just from gold, but from metals of the platinum group. So we're looking really at gold, at platinum, at palladium, at iridium, ruthenium, rhodium, and osmium. So these are the metals that primarily one can manufacture this substance from. It can also be done with copper and nickel and one or two other metals, but mainly it's the platinum groups and the gold. Now, what's been discovered is that it depends upon the metal that it begins by being quite what it might do, but it's a little bit like if you think about sort of vitamins that people take, and if they take a multivitamin, it will do all sorts of things at once, but if they take just A or just B, it's for a designated purpose. And this seems to be the case with this material. The monatomic powder made from gold, for example, seems to have its main effect on the pineal gland. And what it does is that it actually enhances the operation of the gland so that it produces more of its hormone. And the secreted hormone from the pineal gland is melatonin. Iridium, for example, on the other hand, seems to have an effect on the pituitary gland in particular. And the pituitary gland is responsible for producing serotonin. So in effect, what appears to be the case is that these different metals seem to have their various actions on different glands in the endocrinal system.
Mm-hmm.
And they were related to what we, in today's terms, call the chakra system through the body, which for the most part are sort of related to this sort of glandular structure within the body. And even the ancient tree of life was drawn up on that sort of a basis. When it was graphically drawn, it sort of shone with these sort of glandular power points in it. And so what would be the case would be that the gold or the other metals would be used to produce what might actually be vitamins A, B, C, and D, or they could be mixed together to produce the multi. And it might well be that it was more common to use the multi than we think, because although platinum group metals weren't supposedly discovered, if you look in any encyclopedia, until the 1840s, all of the old texts talk about a white metal, which they called firestone. It was a white metal. What was always known was that it was a silvery-colored, valuable metal. And because platinum hadn't been discovered, people through out the sort of medieval alchemist times and whatever. Everybody thought that it must be tin or mercury or something of that sort. And so they were doing all their experiments with the wrong things. Now, the moment platinums were discovered, and certainly throughout the last few decades, even doing some of the old alchemical experiments using platinum has a completely different result to using mercury, which was poisoning everybody. And so it rather seems that they were using gold and platinums to produce this material.
I want to go in a slightly different direction now. I was very interested in the early part of the book. You mentioned that the that there is a relief at Abydos of Anubis sitting on an ark, while the pharaoh presents a conical loaf of this material.
Yeah.
And I was so interested in the fact that this was in this particular temple, and I was thinking about Mount Horeb being called the Mountain of Flight, and of course there's a rafter in that temple that contains some very extraordinary images indeed.
Yes.
That seem to be of modern technological equipment, tanks and
yeah.
aircraft and so forth. And I wondered then what the secret of Anubis might be, and that the he presides over the dead in the afterlife, but the journey into the afterlife. But what if that was actually a journey of a very different kind, and maybe someone from that era had actually seen these things
yeah.
and brought back? I just wonder if you could sort of comment on all. I know this is a very unformed question, and I apologize for that.
It's a good question, Whitley. I don't really know any more than anybody else does about the nature of those particular carvings. That they're totally intriguing. But Anubis certainly was associated with the afterlife of the pharaohs. And interestingly, remember we've this material was called by the Egyptians. I mean, they had different names for it. The Babylonians used to call it Shemana, Highwood Firestone, that means. The Egyptians called it Mufkut. Now, if you look at the pyramid texts at Saqqara, they refer to a dimension. I mean, for want of a better word, a dimension or a plane of existence of some sort in which the pharaohs are said to live with the gods, and they call that dimension the field of Mufkut. So, in as much as that Anubis is clearly associated with this, and we see the pharaoh presenting one of these bread cakes actually to the jackal gods sitting on an ark, actually, it rather seems that the material itself, the Mufkut, was very much to do not just with the pharaoh's life and with his own active longevity, etc., but also with the afterlife. In whatever form they imagined it, they called it the Field of Mufkut. And it was quite apparent that although the pharaoh was deemed to be dead here on earth, that they figured that he was going to be living with the gods in this Field of Mufkut, as it states. An interesting scenario emerges because what modern science has now discovered is that this stuff has some really remarkable properties, and truly remarkable. It's superconductive. It will travel in frequencies. It will harness energy and hold energy and transport energy. It will travel in light waves. It's anti-gravitational, or it can be made anti-gravitational so that it levitates, and it also has the power within it to resonate in different dimensions of space-time so that it becomes totally and utterly invisible. And what struck me as amazing was that in the tests that have been done, for example in the anti-gravity tests, it does seem to have the power to transfer its own weightlessness to whatever it's on. In the laboratory situation, for example, it would be in a pan sitting on a set of scales. And once it had moved into a sort of a weightless, a zero gravity state, the pan itself was actually weighing less than it did before the powder was put into it.
My word.
And so, one, it has this power of levitation. Now, following from that, if you keep on heating this stuff, carry on heating it, it gets lighter and lighter, and it reaches a point where it will totally disappear from sight. And the Institute for Advanced Studies in Austin, in Texas, there,
yes, I know Hal Pudoff
made
there
the point
very well.
That, yeah, that it was, at that stage, it would be resonating in a different dimension, at which point it would become totally invisible. And this seems to be the case. And what made me wonder about this, it was just a thought, and it's a scenario really rather than a proof of anything, but my mind went back to the field of Mufkutz in which the pharaohs were said to live in the afterlife. It went back to the old kingdom pharaohs, none of whose bodies have ever been found. It went back to the empty sarcophagus that was found in the Great Pyramid, and the fact that all this sarcophagus had in it was a scattering of this white powder. And it's entirely possible, although I've not known the experiment to be done, but in fact, what scientists are working on now, certainly in stealth aircraft technology, and they're doing this at the Phantom Works at Boeing in Seattle, they're doing it here at British Aerospace, and various places are working on new stealth technology. And the object is to use superconductive mechanisms to make stealth aircraft not just anti-gravitational, not just undetectable by radar, as they are now, but to make them totally invisible by moving them in a different parallel dimension of space-time. Now, if modern science is looking at the possibility of this and considers that, yes, it is a possibility, then it might just be that the ancient Egyptians and Babylonians knew exactly about that. They may not have understood it, they would have had different names for it, but they might just have had the ability to transpose things into other dimensions of space-time, and that might just have been where these old kingdom pharaohs went to.
Now, let me ask you this. We touched on this a moment ago, but I am absolutely fascinated, of course, with the idea of getting some of this myself and trying it on myself. Now, before you answer the question as to whether or not it's available and safe, etc., and if you've ever tried it, we want to take a little break. We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. This is Whitley Strieber, it's Dreamland. We're talking to Lawrence Gardiner, author of Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark, Amazing Revelations of the Incredible Power of Gold. And before we went on our break and listened to a lovely commercial about your book, I was asking you about the availability of this substance and if you've tried it.
Okay. There are two ways for the substance to be available. One is that it can be manufactured directly from gold or from the platinum group metals. The other is that it can be found in sets of natural circumstances. I mentioned earlier the stardust that NASA and Washington University are working on. And they have said that this material is identical to some small grain particles that they found in deep seabeds. Now, in fact, not only in deep seabeds, but sometimes in old volcano sites this stuff has been found, it seems to be that there is a natural formation of monatomic elements in certain parts of the Earth caused by meteorites. Now, if you take a metal, for example, like iridium, one of the platinum group, iridium is not native to this Earth at all. It's only an extraterrestrial metal. It is only brought in by meteorites. So when one finds the sort of rare iridium seams that there are, which is why it's so expensive, what we have is a situation where meteorites have just plunged it down into the Earth. However, on other occasions, what seems to have happened is that when these meteorites come into the Earth's atmosphere, they burn up, they get enormously hot, and on impact, it can actually implode the iridium within them and break it down into a monatomic substance. So one can find monatomic substances, as some people have in certain farm soils or in other sites, certainly down in the Gulf of Mexico, on the seabed there, in the Dead Sea in Israel, that this stuff is apparent. So the question on how to get it is that there are two ways the material can be obtained. One, it can be obtained in a manufactured form directly from the metals, which is very expensive, or it can be obtained in a way whereby the trace elements have been collected from these sites. And there are a number of companies on the internet now. I mean, they've just sort of appeared over the last few years that are advertising this sort of product. Now, I can't really make recommendations at this stage.
No.
I'm having certain of the products tested. I've got the Elements and Materials Department at Oxford University working on it right now, and they are getting a little help from Harwell Laboratories here in Oxford. And I'm just looking at the makeup of these substances. What I'm interested to see is that what I know that they should test as silica, aluminum, calcium, iron, that they do test as these substances. And so on that basis, what I'm planning to do in the not too distant future is to put a few of these items on my website, not for sale or even as recommendations, but simply to say, look, here are the different ways it could be obtained, and these are ones I've had tested, and these are a good product. Now, whether they're going to do all the things for one that the Babylonians and the Egyptians said they would, I don't really know. But there have been some people testing these over the past few years, and they've had some quite extraordinary results. Copper, for example, monatomic copper is quite extraordinary. There are two or three cases that I know of where in a period of just a year or so of regular ingestion of monatomic copper, that guys with grey hair have gone back to their normal colour. Those taking some of the platinum group monatomic elements have experienced all sorts of things. Skin seems to tighten up in older age, baggy eyes seem to disappear, that sort of thing. I mean, generally, they do seem to have a sort of a youth-giving effect. But clearly, you know, what the case was in olden times was that once embarked on this, it was very regular and it was permanent. It wasn't something that you just did for a couple of months and expected wonders to happen. It was a long-term process. Now, I've not actually tried any of it myself at the moment, although I've got a number of samples that I've collected over the years, and I also, when I first started being interested in this back in 1997, I was over there in the States and was actually present when some of it was made from a Canadian maple leaf coin and whatever, so I got to know the process. What I'm going to do is, once I finish these tests, I've decided I've got a birthday coming up in just a few weeks' time, and that'll be an easy date to remember for logging. So I'm going to have a go from I'm going to pick the one that I'm going to try and see what happens. I mean, my real interest in it is not so much about the ingestion, you know. I mean, if one buys it and it's made from gold or from platinum, then it can cost quite a lot of money.
Yes.
And really, you know, if one seems to think it's being taken to live a few years longer, well, you know, that could cost you a lot of dollars a week for the privilege.
Right.
It might not work. So I don't know. But there are other extraordinary medical attributes to it. For example, the Platinum Metals Review published an article not long ago. And they made the point in their article that if you take one atom, one single atom of ruthenium, which is a monatomic state piece of ruthenium, and you place this atom on the end of a DNA strand within the body's cellular structure, you just go to the helix and you pop this on, what it does is to dismantle the DNA strand. It is a monatomic substance. It will dismantle
it,
the strand.
Dismantles it.
And it will enable it to rebuild itself. But it will only rebuild itself in accordance with its memory. DNA strands have memory. They're like things in the computer. Now, the interesting thing about this, and what seems to be interesting the medical fraternity, is that if you have a malformed cell, if you have a deformed DNA, and you do this to it, it will not rebuild itself in a deformed state. It will only rebuild itself as it should be in accordance with its memory. Now, this is the greatest ever potential cure for cancer, because cancer is nothing more than deformed cell structures. It's exactly what it is. It's based on a malformed DNA. So if you can actually, without surgery, without drugs, without radiation, if you can actually repair cancerous cells and put them back to a normal state by use of this sort of process, then actually that to me is worth all the research that's ever been done on it. Because, I mean, it doesn't really matter about ingesting it and bread cakes and things like that, but that alone would be astonishing. And they're now working on a nanotechnology which is producing body-roaming computers that are so small they can fit within a full stop at the end of a sentence. They're tiny, tiny little things, and they can roam about the body, and they're the sort of machines that will actually be able to make these atomic placements. And so we're looking forward to something quite exciting on that front. I mean, it'll be a little while before it gets to the forefront of our general press and media, but it'll happen, and it will be a wonderful, wonderful thing to be able to cure, you know, the last bad disease that we've got by that means without surgery.
It occurs to me that maybe those enormous longevities mentioned in the Bible were not lunar related to the lunar cycle as people now think, but actually were annular.
Well, it's possible. I mean, it's ever so difficult to say, isn't it, really? And I don't want to hang my hat on anything, but it seems it's not just in the Bible, you know, it's in old Mesopotamian texts and whatever. There seems to have been an ability through a particular period of time for at least those in positions of power, if not everybody, we're looking at the kings, the sort of patriarchs of nations and those sort of people, to actually have quite incredibly long lifespans.
Right.
And, I mean, who knows? It might just be that people could have lived for hundreds of years. I mean, actually, when you think about it, we're looking at substances here that have effects on bodily hormone secretions. By doing that, they will, by virtue of their very nature, have an effect on enzymes within the body. Now, the aging process within you or me or anyone is really caused by the lack of production of an enzyme called telomerase. A telomerase is quite extraordinary. As we grow, what happens is that our cells keep dividing. They divide and they become two, and then each of the two divides and becomes four, and so it goes on, and then other ones die off. We keep replicating these cells, and it happens by virtue of the cell structure contains something a little bit like the plastic bit on the end of a shoelace. They're called telomeres, and as each time they divide, the telomeres get shorter because each cell has half of what was there before. And they get shorter and shorter and shorter until they reach an optimum and critical length. And that's the point at which we start to go downhill and get older. Age rather than growing.
Right.
So we move into a sort of a reverse pattern. Now, it's been calculated in actual fact that as long as we can enhance and produce more telomerase, then what actually happens is that the telomeres don't shorten at such a critical rate. A telomerase, for example, is very, very rich in mother's milk. It's a primary enzyme for feeding children. Males carry it in their reproductive systems, but it's not part of our body as such. We just lose it as we get older. But if this material, these white powder substances, if monatomic substances actually have an effect, and it's not known yet, if they have an effect on enzyme production in just the same way that they do on hormonal production, then the answer to the question is yeah. They really could have an effect on lifespan in quite a tremendous way, because as long as they're helping the body to produce more of this particular enzyme, the telomeres won't shorten in the way that they actually do, and it'll be a lot longer before we plateau out to reach the stage where we've stopped growing and start declining.
It's absolutely fascinating. It's quite awesome. And let's now talk a little bit about the science that must have gone into this in the distant past, because we are talking, after all, about a pretty sophisticated process in terms of creating the substance in the first place, a process much more sophisticated than we give the Egyptians credit for in terms of their technological capabilities. Now, I have to ask you, there is a picture in the book. And, oh, by the way, listeners, this book is marvelously illustrated. Like all of Lawrence's books, it is just a magnificent a production from a production standpoint. It's lovely. And I'm looking at one of the beautiful pictures in it now. And this is, of course, the relief at the Temple of Hathor in Dendera that you have of this object that seems to have a serpent in it. And then there's another one being held by what looked like one is being held up by, it could be a gigantic vacuum tube even.
Yeah.
But what interests me so much about this is the relationship between the serpent and the soul, and why in particular, if it is a vacuum tube, it would contain a serpent. What is going on in this picture? I've always wondered. If there's anyone in the world who can tell us, you can.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have my own thoughts on it, but many people have. They're odd, these objects. I mean, these are enormous reliefs down in the depths of the Temple of Hathor at Dendera. Now, interestingly, Hathor's other temple is the temple at Mount Horeb in Sinai. And so the two places are linked without any doubt at all. And this is where Petrie was, and Dendera is the other temple of Hathor. Now, most of the, well, in fact, all of the above ground part of that temple was rebuilt in Roman times, but the crypt area wasn't really emptied of sand until fairly recent times, actually. And these magnificent and enormous reliefs became apparent on the walls, and they show these sort of priestly characters holding in front of them what look to be like enormous cathode tubes, don't they? Like cathode ray tubes. Great big bubble things with serpents inside. And, you know, if one looks at the height of the man, that they seem to be about two to two and a half men in length, these things. So they're obviously quite light, whatever they are, you know, because he's just sort of holding them out in a couple of hands, and they've got a bit of a support underneath them. Now, people have suggested all sorts of things, that there are those who think that they're part of some strange serpent cult. There are others who've said that they're electric light bulbs. There seems to be a lot of thought that they could in some way be related to electricity, because they seem to have cables coming from them of
yes.
some sort, and they run to sort of a box on which sits a god. There are others who really have homed in, as I think I probably did in the first instance, thinking about Roentgen rays and things like that, X-rays. They really do look like cathode ray tubes. But it's kind of interesting that the more I thought about it, the more I couldn't figure what any of that had to do with Hathor, and these were clearly Hathor things. The serpent was often used. The serpent was always a symbol of healing. It was a symbol of energy, really. It was a symbol for the wise men and for the doctors. It was an energy symbol, or a wise man symbol. Now, the interesting thing about these tubes is that there are other people apart from the priests who seem to be sitting or standing in a supportive position. Now, some of them seem to have their hands underneath the tube, supporting the tube, and others seem to have their hands and arms just going into the body of the tube, as one might perhaps be able to go into a soap bubble if it didn't burst.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is that the snakes change. The snakes within the tubes that have the hands supporting the tubes are different in shape to those where the hands go into the tubes. And sometimes the snakes are have seven bends in them, waves, really, and other times they have five. Now, the energy seems to change with whether the hands are inside the tube or outside. Now, I was discussing this. I couldn't think of anybody better to go to than a nuclear physicist. And I thought, well, I'll just sort of put this to a nuclear physicist and see what he makes of it.
And we're going to find out what Lawrence discovered he made of it in just a couple of minutes. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. When we left the air, we were just about to find out something from a nuclear scientist with Lawrence. Lawrence, what was it?
Okay, well, the first thing that he pointed out was that in all of the reliefs, there are duplications of this particular tube-like construction. There's always a guy on the left holding one out to the right, and there's always a guy on the right holding one out to the left, and they just about are about to touch in the middle. Not quite touching, just about to touch and sort of impinge on each other, the ends of these tubes. And he said quite a remarkable thing. He said, look, don't look at them, perhaps, for what you think you're seeing as the edge of them. Don't think of them as a light bulb or a cathode tube. Think of the serpent as being the key to it, and think of the serpent as if it were the words in a cartoon in a comic. And to emphasize the fact that the words are the important part, what we see is the words put into a bubble coming out of somebody's mouth. Now, the bubble is not the important thing. The bubble doesn't really exist. What exists are the words. Here, he suggested, what exists are the serpents. What is around them, think of it not as a solid object, too much, because obviously it's not. There are guys with their hands and arms going straight through them as if they're not there at all. Think of them as the outlines. Think of them as an aura of some sort. Now, he said, what actually happens is that once you move into the world of discussing superconductivity, which is what the white powder and the Hathor syndrome at Sinai was all about, once you move into that, you're into the realm of Meissner fields. You're into the realm of superconductive magnetic fields with no north or south polarity. If you set up Meissner fields and stick them together, what happens is that you create a flux tube. And this flux tube will become a portal, like a gateway, a stargate, into another dimension of space-time. And the theory was that that's what these could possibly be if we forget the outlines and think about them as simply being something there to inform us that there is within it something important.
You know, there's been some very interesting research lately, and listeners, if you want to follow this research, go to unknowncountry.com and put in the words parallel universe into the search engine on the left-hand side, three-quarters of the way down the site. And you will find research that suggests, A, some of it, that parallel universes may be real, and B, that there's even been a substance observed on a distant asteroid through telescopes that they think may actually be material from a parallel universe, that they may be, when I say real, but I'll define my terms, they may be physically real and all around us. And maybe, therefore, the Egyptians were looking into another very real universe in this immediate area. We had Daniel Pinchbeck on the show a few weeks ago. He is experimenting with iboga, which is a psychedelic substance. It's the sort of thing was never wanted for me to have on when I had my old Dreamland radio program. But now that I'm on my own, I can talk about this stuff, and I just love it. And he's fairly well convinced that he's looking at a real world when he looks through the world of these psychedelic into the world that these psychedelic substances open up to him, that it isn't the production of the mind at all, but a window into another universe. And I'm wondering if, from a vibrational standpoint, perhaps this material can literally change the way the body relates to reality. And maybe you could literally, you could walk into another reality using this somehow. Does that sound at all plausible? Or be projected into it via a technology like the one we are looking at in this picture?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds entirely possible, Whitley. There is an amazing amount of research going on in these fields at the moment. And in fact, Britain's Astronomer Royal, Sir Martin Rees, was on the radio not so very long ago talking for a good length of time about science and the current research into hyperdimensions, as he calls them, parallel dimensions of space-time.
Well, the stuff in your book about parallel dimensions is fabulous.
Yeah. At the moment, it seems that they are sort of aware of about 26 other dimensions. And the trick is being able to sort of access these dimensions at will. Access to the dimensions seems to be triggered by something which science is at the moment simply calling exotic matter. And this is quite intriguing, because if one goes back to 1994 and the tests that were being done then in Arizona with these monatomic white powder substances, when the Institute of Advanced Studies became involved in it briefly, they were talking about its ability to actually manipulate and distort space-time. And they said it could do that because it was exotic matter. Now, exotic matter seems to be a bit of a buzzword now, and exotic matter seems to be not just the key to perhaps unlocking some of these dimensions, which are crumpled. I mean, I was reading something on the NASA site just recently, and they were talking about the research that's going on now at various space laboratories in Britain and America, looking into the manipulation of space-time in order to enable spacecraft to travel enormously long distances. And they know that even at 36,000 miles an hour, it would take a spacecraft something like 80,000 years to reach the next nearest star to us. However, people would die, the fuel would run out, impossible, it's totally impossible. So what they've been looking at for the last few years, in fact since 1994 when the theory was first announced, is why don't we forget logic? Why don't we think laterally on this and actually find a way of, instead of moving this spacecraft and everybody in it at extraordinary speeds and killing everyone, why don't we think about moving the space-time? Taking the time in front of it and crumpling it up and expanding the time behind it, so that with no acceleration, no power, in a flash of an instant, the spacecraft could travel light years by simply manipulating the space-time. And what they're saying is the key to this is exotic matter. And all the time this exotic matter thing keeps cropping up now as being the key to everything. And what we know is that 7 years ago, this material was classified as exotic matter because it did have the ability to bend and manipulate space-time. So I think, you know, whether we're looking at the space race and whether we're looking at moving through light years, whether we're looking, as we were just talking about, access into parallel dimensions, whether we're looking at its use in stealth aircraft technology to enable them to move invisibly in other dimensions of space-time, what resonates all the time with me is the statement from Washington University and from NASA, which actually said, in terms of stardust, they think it'll be the biggest clue ever, better than anything we've ever guessed, as to actually ascertaining the workings and origin of the life force on this planet. And so other dimensions, what we must remember is if they're here now, they were always here. The Egyptians might not have understood the science. The Babylonians might not have used the same words that we use now. They might not have had a clue why it happened. All they knew was that certain things did happen if they did certain things. And they had the field of Mufkutz, for want of another word, and we know what Mufkutz was.
Amazing. You know what we're talking about? We're talking about the lost science of ancient Egypt in the process of rediscovery. Remarkable.
That's the word, really. It's rediscovery. It's not
rediscovery.
It's rediscovery.
Absolutely amazing. Well, I said before that we were going to begin, we were going to get into a discussion of the Templars, and it relates in a most remarkable way to what we are talking, what we have been talking about now. And let's begin to talk a little bit about the Templars. But before we do that, there's something I didn't touch on. We've touched on the possibility of movement into parallel universes, but I wanted to get back to the name of Mount Horeb, the place of flight, the mountain of flight. What about levitation and teleportation? You have some marvelous material about this in the book as well, and we've sort of covered it a little bit, but let me just ask the most straightforward possible question. Could we achieve levitation, perhaps, with using a material like this? Is this within the realm of possibility?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, it's right at the forefront of possibility now. We have our Ministry of Defense here in Britain is working with the Department of Defense in the United States. In fact, in military terms, it's one of the things that is in the very forefront of binding our governments together in at this particular time, which is why we're working so closely on the military front. They are, in real terms, they're using British Aerospace in Britain and they're using Boeing in America. And what they're working on is, with an ultimate objective of stealth technology, but they're looking at aircraft in general. And the theory that begins it is that we're moving into an age now where we're becoming terribly, we're in the age now where we're very environmentally conscious, we're very worried about fossil fuels, not just about the danger that they are to us, but about the fact that they won't last forever anyway. So they know that they've got to find other forms of propulsion and fueling. Now, interestingly, right to the forefront of fuel cell technology, which is supposedly what's going to take over from fossil fuels, steps not BP or Shell or any of the oil companies, but the Anglo-American Platinum Corporation. The Amplats, as they're called, are right at the forefront now of fuel cell technology, and they're working with Johnson Matthey, the precious metals dealers, and they're saying that fuel cells using platinum bases will become the fuel of the future. It's environment friendly, and what we know is that this white powder stuff is capable of storing any amount of energy. Any amount of energy you care to give it, it'll store. It's a bit like a room. If you fill a room up with water, it'll overflow. If you fill it up with something solid, it'll get full up. But try filling a room up with light. You can keep adding more and more and more. There is no limit to the amount of light that you can put in a space.
No.
And so you think of a dimmer switch, you know, that you turn it on and the room's light, and you turn it up a bit and it's brighter, it's got more light. You can keep doing that. Now, this stuff is like that. It carries energy and stores energy in the form of light waves. So a fuel cell made of this material or containing this material would have the ability to store energy. Now, what we also know is that it is superconductive, totally superconductive. And this is what they're interested in now in the aircraft industry, because they know that not only have we got to rid ourselves of the fuels that we're using, we've got to get to a stage where aircraft travel becomes faster and yet safer.
Yes.
They're very conscious of the fact when they look at all of the records that in fact the danger periods in flying are generally the takeoffs and the landings.
Right.
And so question number one, is there a way we can have aircraft travel without taking off and landing? Well, the answer is yes, as long as the plane doesn't have to touch the ground at any time. So you're looking at a hover situation. Is there an exotic matter that can create anti-gravity? Yes, there certainly is.
And it's being worked on now.
It's being worked on, yes, right now as we talk. Now, the other interesting thing about it is that this stuff will travel in frequencies. Once you have a fuel cell made of this, it's just like turning on the radio. It's just like we're talking now, or as your listeners will be listening to the show. All around us, there are frequencies and wave bands. We don't see them, but within them, there are pictures moving around through the internet. There are voices moving across the oceans. All of this stuff is happening within frequencies and wave bands. Now, this stuff will travel in frequencies. So if you actually have an aircraft, which is now levitational, and
Lawrence,
you set it in a frequency,
Lawrence,
and turn the button, away it goes.
We're going to have to take a little brief break, and when we get back, we will continue with this discussion of anti-gravity, and I also want to get into the whole concept of sacred science, since this ancient and incredibly potent science is in the process of being rediscovered, and along with it, an exit door has appeared. We may be able to get out of here, off this planet, very soon and in some extraordinary ways. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We're back. We've been talking to Lawrence Gardner, the author of Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark, Amazing Revelations of the Incredible Power of Gold. And indeed, this has proved to be a truly amazing experience as this brilliant and extraordinary man creates or points the way to a synthesis between the lost ancient science of Egypt and the very leading edge of modern science in fuel cell technology, in even in the movement between, possibly movement between dimensions, teleportation, levitation, an explosive new edge is created. We have a new event horizon in our world. But this is incredibly powerful stuff, Lawrence. And in the past, this was a sacred science, carefully operated in the context of constant awareness of the presence of, quote-unquote, the gods. Maybe the presence of the very real beings in other dimensions. How do you respond to that?
My answer is yes. I mean, I'm open to anything, Whitley.
Just
to finish off the last point.
Sure.
A few words. The aeroplane is now anti-gravitational. It's put into a frequency. The button is turned up, just like turning on the radio, and off it goes. It can be sped up or slowed down within the frequency, but it can't fall out of it. It can never fall out of the frequency. It's anti-gravitational. It's moving in this wave. So what you have is safe aircraft, and they don't actually, they won't need pilots. They'll simply be things that they can just send, like we send radio waves. So that's what they're working on now. As far as that, I mean, I started off this research of mine, 10, 12 years ago, whatever it was, as a very straightforward art historian.
Yes.
Gradually, I mean, I've learned as I've gone along to really not do what academia teaches us, and to put things into boxes, and to close your mind, and to separate science from medicine, and medicine from history, and history from mathematics, and mathematics from religion. They seem to me to be all the same thing. And once you knock down the edges of the boxes, all things seem to become possible. And they interlink, and we have one subject, one overall subject, and it has different aspects. Now, it seems that this is really what the priests of olden times understood much better than our tutors do today. They might not have known so much about various things because the discoveries have been made as we've gone along, but what we do know is that there were technologies that they had and that they were using that we never, ever would have credited them with.
And since then, we've been learning more and more about what the ancients knew about the ancient world, and people like Lawrence Gardner and William Henry are actually cracking some of those codes, and as 2006 becomes 2007, it's a very, very exciting time to be alive. And speaking of William Henry, he'll be interviewing next week. Jay Widener has a new DVD out. He's an extremely popular guest on Dreamland. Don't miss Jay Widener next week. And I'm going to be talking to William Mann, who was on Dreamland a few weeks ago, about an absolutely remarkable subject. William Mann, as you know, comes from a Templar family, actually, who have a family history in the Templars in Canada that's documented, that goes back hundreds of years. He thinks he met the Master of the Key also, and so do not miss that if you're a subscriber.